This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is the European Union at risk of breaking apart? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. As we've discussed before at these microphones, the largest refugee crisis since World War II is overwhelming Europe and threatening the viability of the Schengen, or open borders policy, a cornerstone of the European Union. The fear of terrorism in the wake of the Paris attacks last November is fueling the rise of right-wing nationalist political parties who are hostile to Brussels. In addition, the United Kingdom is set to have a referendum on EU membership, possibly as soon as June. The European Union offered a proposal last week to Prime Minister David Cameron intended to keep Britain as a member of the bloc, setting out compromises on issues like immigration. The documents still need to be approved by the leaders of the other 27 members of the bloc, who, along with Britain, will meet for a crucial summit meeting in Brussels later this month. Opinion polls predict a tight race on the EU question. A recent poll showed that about 38% would vote to remain and 42% would vote to leave the European Union. No other country has ever left the bloc. Indeed, the possibility of a so-called Brexit, along with the continuing challenges posed by the migrant crisis, illustrate that nothing less than the future of the EU is at stake. And if all these challenges were not enough, there is the need to deter aggression by Vladimir Putin's Russia. Russia violated sovereign borders by annexing Crimea and stoking civil war in Ukraine. Most recently, he has intervened in Syria to prop up the regime of Bashar al-Assad under the pretext that Moscow is fighting terrorism. The Pentagon has put Russia at the top of the list of U.S. national security threats with a plan to increase the deployment of heavy weapons, armored vehicles, and troops on a rotating assignment to NATO countries in Central and Eastern Europe. Well, with us to discuss the state of Europe and transatlantic relations in light of these many challenges are two distinguished analysts. Alina Polyakova is Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a Washington-based policy group. And Ivan Vevoda. He's the Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and that's a nonprofit organization also based here in Washington that aims to strengthen transatlantic cooperation. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Alina Polyakova at the Atlantic Council, let me begin with you in talking about the migrant crisis. We talked about this last year with both of you. What's the latest since our last conversation? Is the EU any closer to having a coherent solution to accommodating these many refugees, mostly fleeing the civil war in Syria?
I think what we've seen over the last few months is the EU is really struggling to integrate and to really address the migrant challenge. And in a way, this is only accelerated since we were last on the program here. Now we know some of the numbers from last year, and we know that over 1.2 million registered refugees have entered the EU in 2015 alone, and the projection is for an additional 3 million to enter in 2016. Of course, Germany has been at the forefront of this with its open door policy, accepting almost 1 million of those refugees, so a large proportion. But Greece right now is really becoming a hotspot. The Greek government, which has been struggling financially, is struggling to really accommodate these migrants. And I think the EU's push to sign a deal with Turkey, which will limit the number of migrants, I don't think this will have much of an effect, to be honest with you. So we've seen the situation just worsen since we were last on the show.
Turning to you, Eva and Vevoda, for your perspective on where we stand with a more coherent policy, to what extent is that $3 billion deal with Turkey having any kind of impact? Is Turkey keeping more migrants from going to Europe? And what about the challenges for Greece, Macedonia, and other countries that are being overwhelmed?
Absolutely agreeing with Alina. You know, Europe is struggling to move in the direction of a comprehensive solution. And that is really the only possible solution, one where everyone partakes. I would add to what Alina said that there have been some notable steps over the past weeks. I myself was in Berlin last week and had a number of policy meetings. The Turkish Prime Minister was in Berlin just to address this issue that the agreement with Turkey was not working that was made about a month ago in Brussels with the President Erdogan and the Prime Minister. And so I think that the screws have been tightened, if I can use that kind of colloquial expression, in that either Turkey steps up to its promises and thus it will get the $3 billion that was promised, and that's very important. And the donor conference that was held in London just this week is very important because it is about putting a pot of money together for all of these issues, of which Turkey is an important part. There's also been a number of meetings related to the Western Balkan route. The countries of Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia have agreed on a joint biometric document now that they would share. And I think this is a very positive step. This week, we at the German Marshall Fund hosted the Macedonian Minister of Defense, who actually said that since end of last summer, they are cooperating more with Greece in an attempt to coordinate these flows. But Alina is absolutely right. Greece is really a focal point. And in fact, this week, again, Greece was given a sort of ultimatum — is too strong a word maybe, but you know, either or. Either you as a country step up your efforts in actually documenting these people, and also, frankly, it is a European Union solution, i.e. you need that European police to help the Greek police those myriad islands where refugees can disembark coming from Turkey.
Indeed. Well, turning back to you, Alina Polyakova, to talk a little bit more about Greece and this sort of ultimatum that if Greece didn't sort of step up and take this kind of help and coordinate better, that they could possibly be excluded from Schengen area. Is that correct?
I think Greece faces a very difficult situation. We shouldn't really underestimate the fact that the Greek economy has undergone the greatest shock. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways, it's not even really in the interest of the Greek government right now, Prime Minister Tsipras specifically, to devote more resources to registering these migrants properly. So they are pushing back against this EU policy that in some ways Tsipras has in the past advocated for an EU exit for Greece as well. He was defeated in the polls when he tried to push the referendum, but this is a rising sentiment in Greece as well, that maybe an EU exit would not be the worst thing for the country.
Quickly, back to you, Ivan, just to clarify, Greece would accept, you know, more resources, both technical, human, and financial, to deal with this problem. Are they receiving that from the EU?
Well, that's what's actually been discussed for the past weeks, but I would say that those negotiations are really now ongoing because everybody feels that this is the moment to act. And thus, this coordinated activity with Turkey, the fact that the Prime Minister was in Berlin, is exactly part of that. So the Turks have to set up mechanisms and procedures that they don't allow these people actually to take boats. Secondly, Greece will be allowed to send back refugees within a span of 24 to 48 hours. So there's a lot of moving parts that are being actually now decided, because the flow of refugees has to be stemmed, because really the cities in Germany, in Sweden, in Denmark are really bearing the brunt of this.
Well, back to you, Alina Polyakova, to look at, to some extent, the root of the crisis, or one of the roots. One can't really talk about how to solve the migrant refugee crisis without discussing how to end the Syrian conflict, because probably a large portion, if not the majority, of those refugees are fleeing predominantly the regime of Bashar al-Assad, the Russian airstrikes continuing to target Syrians who oppose Assad, but not necessarily targeting the ISIS strongholds. To what extent do you think that European leaders feel that perhaps the United States isn't doing enough or didn't act early on enough to have actually prevented, you know, this crisis to begin with? And while we can't turn back the clock, that leads us to ask, is it perhaps time for the EU, the United States, and maybe NATO to consider establishing a safe zone within Syria again, to create space for refugees to remain in Syria, as opposed to coming out again challenging the EU, as well as trying to end the war?
Well, Carol, I think you really hit the nail on the head there, because obviously we can't discuss what's happening in Europe without really addressing the root cause of the refugee crisis, which is, of course, the ongoing war in Syria. And just recently, the peace talks in Geneva with Syrian opposition fell apart before they even got started. A lot of this had to do with the fact that Russia, in coordination with Assad, was still carrying out airstrikes, which the opposition did not want to accept, and going to peace talks under those conditions. So those peace talks right now are stalled. On the other hand, the countries around Syria, places like Jordan, that have so far been very willing to accept the outflows and the overwhelming numbers of refugees, have recently pointed out that they just no longer have the capacity. King Abdullah of Jordan recently said that Jordan has hit a boiling point in terms of their ability to absorb these refugees. And I think this question of what should the U.S. role be in this, I think in the humanitarian effort, just recently Secretary Kerry did say the U.S. would commit, I believe, an additional 900 million to the humanitarian effort. The EU will likely commit more. However, the UN is at a huge shortage still for addressing the humanitarian crisis in Syria. And without more investment, both from the US and its partners, I don't think the situation is going to change. In terms of this question of what should our real strategy be for resolving this conflict in Syria, I think what we've seen, given the presidential campaign in the US, we are seeing, I think, to some extent, the candidates really coming to the same conclusion, which is exactly the safe zone question.
Turning to you, Ivan Vaivoda, for your perspective, because it's all well and good, the humanitarian aid, but Jordan is at a boiling point, as Alina said. The outflow continues, the peace talks have stalled, and it's quite obvious now that Iran, Russia, who are backing Syria, they are not interested in peace, because as the talks were trying to get off the ground, they were bombing the smithereens out of mainstream opposition. Now, this is the question. Should the United States, the EU, NATO start talking seriously about a safe zone inside Syria? But again, let's not be naive. This is taking on, Russia and Iran to some extent. So talk about the possibility, the probability, or the prospects of this.
Absolutely. I mean, many things to say here. One, the Vienna talks were, in terms of format, very important because all the countries that were involved were at a table. So Iran, the US, Russia, Saudi Arabia. That's a good starting point. But as we see with the stalling of the talks, that, Russia is trying to help Assad to carve out more territory for himself, that won't go anywhere. It is when they start speaking with a single idea of a goal of how to move forward, then we will see maybe a real addressing of the root causes. I would add Libya to the mix, frankly, because the ISIS certainly is gaining ground there. We're looking at another very potential poisonous place that could exacerbate all of the things that we're talking about. And again, linking it to the migrant route, there was talk about setting up a hard border between Greece and Macedonia. I frankly found that flippant because a few hundred kilometers of border, refugees just go around them.
Exactly.
The Italian government has been preparing for a number of months of a possible return to what's called the Albanian Adriatic route. So if they can't go north, they will then turn sort of left and westwards to Albania, cross the Adriatic like the Albanians did in the 90s, and then go through Italy again.
Well, quickly before I go to a break, from your context within the EU, NATO, do you see an interest in now perhaps a safe zone, some kind of establishment of this the type of mechanism?
Look, this is an issue that's always been talked about, and one cannot not go back to the conflict in former Yugoslavia and in Bosnia, where the safe zones were created, and we know that, unfortunately, the UN didn't do its job, and the massacre and the genocide in Srebrenica occurred. So I think everybody's tiptoeing. They realize that this is important, so a no-fly zone or a safe zone, it's always been on the table. I mean, that was one of the cases in Libya, in fact, around Benghazi. So hard to tell from where we all sit where this is going.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Alina Polyakova. She's Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, a Washington-based policy group, and Ivan Vaivoda, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, also based in Washington. We're discussing the challenges facing the European Union as it grapples with the largest refugee crisis since World War II, and soon we'll be talking about the United Kingdom as it prepares for a referendum on EU membership. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter.
You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Elena from Belarus. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Alina Polyakova, to talk about the so-called Brexit, the proposal that the United Kingdom now is considering from the EU, number of compromises. Where do you think this is going?
It's an excellent question. I mean, on top of the refugee crisis and everything else, the EU is now having to deal with Brexit. I think these negotiations, we will see them passed on to the 28 member states between Cameron and President Tusk, the president of the European Union right now. So we will see where that comes. But I do think that we will see a referendum. And at this point, it could go either way. What I think this sets a precedent, however, for other countries who are also considering a potential exit. And we see the rising kind of sentiment among the population in various European countries, that this may be a path for them as well. So if Britain is able to negotiate a deal out, this will set a precedent for other countries as well. And in places like France, this is becoming increasingly more of a popular idea because the refugee crisis has really, I would say, fomented the notion that the EU is unable to control its own borders, that national governments are burdened with these refugees and they have no control over these inflows. And in particular, the far-right groups are benefiting from this extremely. We've seen Marine Le Pen, who's the leader of the National Front in France, gain at the polls recently. Her party is polling at 30% now, which is the highest. And she could potentially be a candidate for the presidency in France. And these kinds of numbers are quite shocking across Europe. And of course, people like Le Pen are calling for a so-called Frexit. And this is, you know, this is obviously, you know, a clear call to, you know, if Britain gets out, why shouldn't we? Even Italy now, the once dead so-called Lega Nord party there is now at 16% to 17%, which is, you know, the highest it's ever polled in recent history. And as we see the rise of these far-right populist groups that are calling for European exit, I think we're in a very dangerous trajectory for the EU as a whole.
Ivan Vejvoda, are we on a very dangerous trajectory for the EU, as we said in the beginning, and we've heard this talk of so-called breakup of the EU being threatened by the migrant crisis, the UK considering leaving the bloc. How do you see this?
Well, let me put it up front and very simply. I don't think the EU will break apart, but it will become different. I don't see a French exit. I don't see an Italian exit. I see a lot of strains, and Alina is absolutely right to point out the rise of these right-wing movements. Pegida in Germany, the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, they have an extremely outspoken person who actually wants to shoot back at refugees. This was a statement that she gave just several days ago. And mainstream parties are under huge pressure. In fact, around 50 members of Chancellor Merkel's party wrote her a letter addressing this issue and trying to convince her to do otherwise. She had a meeting with the heads of the German states, the lender, where they decided also that, you know, families would not be taken in over a period of 2 years. So they're mitigating a lot of these issues. Brexit is in no one's interest, not in the United States' interest, and the United States, through President Obama directly, has said, you know, folks, really think about what you're doing. Whether that will have any influence, that's another question. France has come out with a very detailed study of how much the breakup of Schengen would cost them. It's in the billions. Everyone's aware of what Schengen means, not only for us who travel there and then we don't have to, you know, show our passports or change currency. It's really one of the bedrocks of the success of the European economy because there's a free flow of goods as if it were one country. Also, there's a huge danger that Britain itself breaks up, that if exits, the Scots will then definitely leave the country. There is a question, what does Ireland do, which is further west and thus loses this geographical link, if we can put it, across the British Isles? So a lot of questions. It must be said that there is a sort of a beginning of a compromise that Donald Tusk, the head of the EU, and David Cameron reached again this week. David Cameron is campaigning for Britain to stay in. We'll see. I mean, as Alina said, it's a toss-up. Very difficult to say at this moment how it will fall.
Well, quickly before I turn back to Alina, Of course, we need to differentiate between Brexit, the UK leaving the EU bloc, but also Schengen. They're not a part of the Schengen, which is, allows passport-free travel. But quickly, do you think that Schengen is wounded or just suspended? Is it at
risk?
Well,
formally it's just suspended, but it's definitely shaken up because, you know, when two countries that couldn't be closer, like Sweden and Denmark, when, you know, they decide to put up new border controls and check people's documents rather than just seeing cars flow over that famous bridge that connects them, I think that's a sign of the times, that everyone is turning inwards again and saying, look, we need to fend for ourselves. We're not just going to let people come in like that. There's this jewelry law that was voted in, you may have seen in Denmark, where they have decided to take the belongings of refugees. And this is extremely troubling. These are throwbacks, and one cannot not think to World War II and Germany and what Germany did.
Absolutely, no question about it. Of course, there's the fear, the terror attacks in Paris, the foreign fighters coming back from Syria posing a threat. One can't underestimate the fears, but it doesn't justify some of these measures. There's no question about it. Let's hope that Schengen, although altered, will still remain a viable concept. But Alina, in the few minutes we have left, we need to look again at the rightward turn of many political parties in Europe and to what extent Vladimir Putin's Russia is also fueling this. He may even be funding some of these parties. And again, in a corollary question, does the European Union also see, like the United States has recently declared, that Russia is now becoming much more of a threat based on what it did in Ukraine, based on its actions in Syria?
The Russian angle here really should not be ignored. I think what's happening in Europe is very much playing into the foreign policy interests of Russia under President Putin. And specifically, what I mean by that is that we've seen Russia develop is a sort of toolkit of unconventional warfare. So we've seen the conventional warfare, which is, you know, military intervention, annexation of Crimea, fomenting military war in eastern Ukraine and still having troops there as well. And of course, the military airstrikes in Syria. And also Russia does have troops on the ground in Syria now as well. Russia's then on the other side, this unconventional toolkit, is that it has used its muscles of political influence and also influence through the media space. And one political influence tool Russia has had at its disposal and it has used is, of course, support of any extremist groups. It has done this on the left and on the right. But, of course, Russia's investment on the far right has paid off much more handsomely than its investment on the far left, particularly because these parties are now gaining in their own national governments, particularly in Germany, which is, I will highlight, is a very unique case because Germany has not had any sort of far-right party of any influence. And now the AfD, which Ivan mentioned earlier, is polling at about 11%, which for Germany is very high. And this presents some challenges for Merkel, who, of course, has been, you know, the strong woman at the helm, who has been seen as the strong voice against Putin, who's also been struggling with her own open-door policy for migrants. And her ratings, her approval ratings, have been declining to a great deal because of that. I think right now she's at her lowest ratings in the last 4 years. And what we've seen Russia do, of course, we don't have financial records necessarily, with the exception of the National Front, which did receive a massive $40 million euro loan from a Russian-owned bank. There have been, of course, many rumors that Russia has financially supported far-right parties like Jobbik, which is perhaps one of the most extremist parties in Europe today. But aside from the, you know, very direct evidence of finance, we know that these parties maintain relationships with Putin's Russia. And I think going forward, these parties have already become, you could say, Putin's useful idiots. And I think that's just going to increase. We're going to see these kinds of groups advocating not for European foreign policy interests, but for Russia's foreign policy interests in European institutions.
Ivan Vaivoda, the last word to you on the threat that you see from Russia, whether it's their aggression in eastern Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, continuing airstrikes in Syria on behalf of Bashar al-Assad, threatening the Baltic states, and also now, you know, helping with the rise of some of these right-wing nationalist parties.
I concur with everything that Alina has said. What is happening in Europe is to their benefit. They would like to see the whole project fail, the support to Ukraine to fail. They can't wait. But obviously, you know, they know also that they have weaknesses. You know, they have the declining demographics, the sanctions are biting, the price of oil is hurting them. And yet, having said that, we all together need to work with them, because without them, there won't be a solution in Syria. It's this famous
balancing act.
Deterrence on the one hand, pushing back, and what NATO is doing now, putting heavy weapons that you mentioned at the beginning, and on the other hand, engagement. But being fully cognizant of what Russia, as Alina explained in detail, what they're doing, and being aware of it, and how do we counter those activities.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Alina Polyakova, she's Associate Director of the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council, and Ivan Vevoda, Senior Vice President of Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Rob McLean, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.